are quite incredibly moving to the right, as I've said, but not moving to the right in a traditional way. Traditional right in the Conservative Party, as I understand it, would be seen as moving back to the a conservative position of trying to have a England of the past. The kind of radical conservatism that Margaret Thatcher represents does not get much support from the Tory squirearchy. And indeed, I used to look at the way in which the Tories got their name and the Whigs got their name and think, well, how on earth do these names stick? And how do political factions get their names? And it amused me when, just because of the way in which Margaret Thatcher used to refer to the people she didn't approve of in her own party, she would say, oh, he's wet. And now the whole liberal wing of the Conservative Party is called the wet wing. We have a new terminology in British politics. The dries are the Thatcherites, and the wets are the Edward Heaths, who I believe it was here 4 years ago. The Edward Heaths and the Francis Pyms and that traditional, rather aristocratic wing of the Conservative Party. That conservative part of the Conservative Party that believed in noblesse oblige, of providing a welfare state for ordinary working people, because that was what the squire did in the 18th and 17th century, that there was a good relationship between the squire and the worker, and one looked after one's workers in a possible way, in a positive way. What has happened with Thatcherism, that Thatcherism, I think, is not seen by many people in this way, but it is, in my view, it is a kind of, not an authoritarian populism, rather it is a kind of working class Toryism, of a new kind, of working class Toryism. A whole emotion of the appeal of Thatcherism and the Conservatives under Thatcher is to a kind of an appeal that we have seen for a long time in British politics. It goes much more to Herbert Spencer and social Darwinism. That, you know, and it's very familiar in American politics, this appeal of, you know, the self-made man. The appeal of letting people get on with their own lives, this freedom from state interference. And the hallmark of that is privatisation. Let government get out of the hair of the people. Let them get on with their own health arrangements and their social security arrangements. Let them get on with producing wealth because that's the only thing to do, because welfare payments will be reduced to an unacceptably low level. Let people do their own thing and produce their own wealth. One of the sad things about that move has been that the British people seem to be not responding very well to the treatment. And someone said it's like having someone suffering from something like pneumonia and taking the life support system away and expecting the patient to become immediately healthy. But the facts of the matter are this, that the Conservative Party at the moment is also, I believe, only in a very temporary majority position, because of this fundamental nature of the reality of this 30-30-30 split in British political support. What about the future of the Labour Party? You might say I've been evading the question. I will come back and say, in a sense, this, that what was wrong with the Labour Party in the 1960s was, and the criticisms that were made of the Labour Party in the 1960s were, I think, absolutely correct criticisms. That the Labour Party had become the Tweedledum to the Conservatives' Tweedledee. And it didn't seem to matter much which way you voted. I can remember a famous examination question when I was trying to graduate, which pointed out that Barry Goldwater was far more radical in the context of British American politics compared to Johnson at that time, than the choice between Harold Wilson and Alec Douglas Hume in British politics. And remember Goldwater's slogan, a choice, not an echo. I think very much what the Labour Party had wanted was a choice, not an echo, for British people. And I think that we're going through an uncomfortable change. The pendulum can always swing too far in these things, so that you actually inhibit growth of a party. So you narrow its appeal by a more ideological approach. That, I think, has been a process which was inevitable for the pendulum to swing the other way from Butskillism through to a much more closed ideological approach. I think that in a sense that may still be a necessary and acceptable therapy that the party has gone through. And what may well emerge is a new consensus, a party that actually seriously thinks about its policy-making process and the ability to deliver radical policies to working people and their families, and working people more broadly conceived than the Labour Party ever in the past accepted. In other words, what I will argue today is that there are two alternatives for the Labour Party. One is a realistic alternative that means, in part, going back to the conventional wisdoms, recognising there is a centre in British politics, realising that there is a limit to the ideological appeal of hardline socialist policies, but that what there is in between is a real possibility of producing policies that actually does distribute the wealth of Britain in a more equal way, that does produce welfare policies that help people who are in need, and also produces economic policies that will build the wealth and success that is a fundamental necessity for distributing and changing people's lives in a positive direction. In other words, the challenge for the Labour Party today is to get those policies right, to have the leadership to sell them, and the organisation to deliver the votes on the day. That is the Shearman perspective when I'm in my manic phase. When am I in my depressed phase, which my wife is sitting at the back will tell you about, late at night after a political meeting of particularly narrow kind, my view is that the Labour Party's other path is to continue on a desire. I remember seeing in the 1930s a lovely song of the 1930s which was called The Ultimate Sectarian. It was about a man that couldn't ever get a party policy and a party that absolutely fitted him down to the ground. And at the end of The Ultimate Sectarian, the song says he goes out and forms his only party with a membership of one. And you can get in a political party that sectarian, that ideologically closed. That is the depressive path, I think. It's a path that is still open, and it is possible that the Labour Party will follow. But I believe that there are some exceedingly good people in the Labour Party at the present moment, including the new leader, Neil Kinnock, who I believe is very much underrated, not only in this country, but by a large number of people. I think that a leader of his calibre and the sort of leadership that's still around in the Labour Party actually has the ability to, if you like, get some kind of synthesis that is imaginative and real and can actually lead the Labour Party back to victory as a radical party delivering policies that alters people's lives in a meaningful way. In a sense, I'm going back to where I started, that there is a centre in British politics. You ignore it at your peril. If a sectarian Labour Party is the survival, then I believe that what will happen in the next two elections is a new party, and I don't know which one it is, because interestingly enough, with the STP's desire to get votes that they believe will be disaffiliated and disaffected Conservatives, if you watch it in parliamentary terms, the Social Democratic Party is leaping over the Conservative Party in order to look more of an appealing party to Conservative voters or naturally Conservative voters. Indeed, to the stage when a well-known parliamentarian called Dennis Skinner pointed out that David Owen's time in parliamentary Prime Minister's questions ought to be added to Mrs. Thatcher's, because they said rather the same thing when it came to supplementaries. But I don't think that is something we concern ourselves with today. My view is that the Labour Party has a future. It has a very positive future. And that's important for any student and any believer in democracy anywhere in the world. because I believe that the British political system has, over a very long period, delivered something unique. It has delivered choice to people, and that choice has narrowed in the 1960s to what I call Butskillism, but now, with a renewal of the political parties, is offering choice again. I believe that choice in a modified form will mean that the Labour and Conservative parties are the real choices for the future. If that is the case, I think the dangers and the difficulties of the future, and Britain is not nearly out of the woods, as you know, economically and socially yet. But the real challenge is that a government can emerge in Britain which can create wealth by combating the vicissitudes of international markets, in other words, being able to produce things that other people want, and also to combat great changes in technology that we're faced with. I think any government is faced with that very real challenge in the future. Home, domestic, economic perspectives. Unfortunately, I think that the British government and the British people will play a declining role in international affairs over the next 20 years. They will become much more of a European power, working with their European partners. But I believe that the future, in terms of, and that's what government is about, isn't it? Delivering the good life, as far as we can achieve it, to ordinary men and women, that is the future that faces us. I think the Labour Party is going to be able to pick up that ball and run with it. And the last thing I will say is I think it's a very difficult job in a democracy. We underrate it. We underrate the processes of democracy, and we underrate the actors in a democracy. You in your country manage that difficult process in a very difficult and dangerous way. And I never underrate the way in when people criticise the cumbersome method of government that you have in your country, that you govern 50 states with a population that is it is the melting pot population of the world, and you actually do at the end of the day, do what Britain has done to this stage, you have succeeded in giving most people a participatory role in politics and a choice, and in a democratic context. In Britain, I think we actually do that job a little bit better. only in the sense that what and I will finish on this note, what has been going on in the last 20 years in British politics is the resolution of the demand that politics should not be an echo, but a choice, and that choice has to renew itself every few years, every generation perhaps. We are in the process of renewal. Whatever comes out the other end, I believe, will invigorate democracy, and I believe, as a Labour Party politician, that it's going to be a strong, radical Labour Party with all its democratic sensibilities intact. Thank you.
Say only so that he can appear on Nightline tonight in Washington. Barry, you've done this in politics and academically. Could you respond to a few questions?
Sure. Americans always ask questions. Sir. Yeah. The broader implications of the miners' strike. I think the miners' strike is, can I say personally, in terms of having a Yorkshire constituency with miners living in my constituency, what a tragedy that longest major strike in the history of our country has been. I spent the morning with the pickets in just outside my constituency 2 Mondays ago at 4:30 in the morning, and saw what a dedication those people have to that dispute. But I must say that the great difficulty of the dispute has been that the new leadership of the Labour Party has been in the dreadful position where, on the one hand, it believes fundamentally in the case that the miners have for coal and for the communities that produce that coal, and believe that the way in which the dispute was brought about was a very serious mismanagement of the people who have given great service to that industry over 100 years. And as you know, this dispute is about no demand. It's a very odd dispute. The National Union of Mine Workers don't ask for anything. There was no demand on the table. The only reason for the dispute is because the traditional procedures for closing down of mines was abrogated by the management, the National Coal Board, and where they were told that six pits would close without consultation. And in terms of that dispute, in terms of the rightness of the dispute, the Labour Party is 100% behind it. I think the difficulty, and this is off the record, the tragedy is, as Neil Kinnock said, been pushed by the hard left of the Labour Party to become more forthcoming and urge the miners to carry on and so on. Some of us were called Pharisees in that meeting. And Neil Kinnock said, there's another definition of Pharisee. It's the kind of man or woman that will urge someone to fight to the last drop of somebody else's blood. And we are in that dreadful position where when the National Union of Mine Workers failed to get all of the union out, in other words, the most productive coal field, Nottingham, didn't come out, many of us knew that it was going to be very, very difficult to succeed. And I think all of us in the Labour Party actually find it very difficult to urge miners to carry on it with a struggle in which we cannot see a positive resolution of the dispute. And that is why all the energies of the Labour Party have been towards a negotiated settlement to get people back to work and get the central question resolved. But certainly, going back to the main thread of my talk, the interesting thing is that the miners are seen as the last of the traditional unions, the best example of them, still with living in communities with 99% of the people normally would vote Labour and so on. Interestingly enough, the place that we lost seats in 1983 and we must get back in order to win a former government in Nottinghamshire, the people carry on working. Shall we have two more quick ones?
I don't think you would.
I must have a real student ask me a question.
What would prevent a British Labour Party from heading on the same road to failure as the French Socialist Party is today?
Very quickly, I would challenge whether the French Socialist Party is totally unsuccessful at the present moment. I think it's got very, very real difficulties. And of course, it is absolutely the rule of thumb that you can say very often Labour and socialist administrations are only called into government when there is a crisis in the capitalist economy that is often brought about by the mismanagement of the preceding regime. And I think if you look at the regime, some of the great problems, the French economy at the moment, really were there and were mounting under Giscard d'Estaing. And to sort that mess out, an economy with all the problems that Britain's got, all the problems that Western industrial nations have got without our oil. You subtract, if you want to see the success of Mrs. Thatcher, for example, you subtract the totally fortuitous North Sea oil revenues from Britain today and we are a bankrupt country. Mrs. Thatcher's living on the oil revenues and she's a very lucky lady. But what comes after it's run out?
There's so many questions, the only response is to have him back.
Thank you.